Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Mohammed Rafai. Dr. Rafai is an internist and a psychiatrist who also specializes in clinical research, specifically at the intersection of hepatitis and psychiatric conditions. More recently, and more pertinent to the conversation at hand, he was recently acquitted on four charges involving Medicare fraud, including billing one patient who was at two different hospitals, apparently. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Rafai.
Thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity to talk to your audience. I am a psychiatrist and an internist. I am board certified and recertified in psychiatry and internal medicine. I did my residency training at the University of Virginia in internal medicine and psychiatry. And I did my postgraduate training also at the National Institute of Mental Health in Bethesda, Maryland. And I have been in Pennsylvania for almost 20 years now, and in this country for almost 30 years. Originally, my family is from Syria, and my hometown, Aleppo, Syria, is the place of birth for inpatient psychiatric care. Aleppo, Syria has one of the oldest inpatient psychiatric hospitals recorded in history, the Bimaristan of Aragon al-Kamili. Bimaristan is with the word hospital in Arabic, and Aragon al-Kamili is a physician and a governor of that area. And since 1354, that hospital had been providing psychiatric services for people in the Middle East. I have been working on the subject of psychiatric services and providing psychiatric care to underserved population in Pennsylvania for almost 20 years, being involved in the public health service with my work at the National Institute of Mental Health, doing research on hepatitis C and psychiatric issues, as well as providing services to underserved population in rural areas in Pennsylvania. In 2006, I started one of the first emergency psychiatry, telehealth, telepsychiatry programs in the country. And we provided psychiatric services to individuals in rural Pennsylvania through telehealth. And we connected with different psychiatric emergency rooms around Pennsylvania to provide psychiatric services. That led to actually providing psychiatric services to individuals who were in nursing homes, as well as in hospitals around Pennsylvania. We also partnered, my practice, Blue Mountain Psychiatry, partnered with Medicare on a partnership to improve psychiatric care, as well as dementia care in individuals who are in nursing homes, as well as emergency psychiatric services around Pennsylvania. And that collaboration started in 2012. It was at the behest of Medicare. They wanted us to collaborate with them. And in fact, in 2017, toward the end of 2017, Medicare published outstanding results by their own publications and by their own press releases that we've achieved tremendous goals through this partnership by reducing the utilization of psychotropic medications and antipsychotic medications in individuals who were in nursing homes by at least 35%. And by Medicare's own numbers, by the end of 2017, that collaboration, we saved Medicare at least $5 million. Unbeknownst to us, in 2018, the Office of the Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Justice opened an investigation into our practice for a multitude of reasons, and an indictment came in November of 2022 after several years of investigations, after 5 years of investigations. We believed that we had done nothing wrong, and I believed in my innocence, and we elected to go to trial. And as you mentioned, the results of the trial was very positive. The jury found us not guilty on all charges.
That's incredible. Congratulations, particularly as a foreign national coming to this country and practicing medicine. The odds are stacked incredibly against you. And to be able to have the courage to stand up and fight for your innocence and come out vindicated is amazing. Can you talk a little bit about that initial period of investigation, what the communications were like with the OIG and DOJ? And did you ever suspect that at any point it would lead to an indictment?
Sure. So you know, the psychiatry, actually the field of psychiatry is in the source and the soul of the nation in the United States of America. Not a lot of people know, but the founder of American psychiatry is a person by the name of Dr. Benjamin Rush. Mm. His silhouette is on the emblem of the American Psychiatric Association. And I was the president of the American Psychiatric Association local district branch in the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania for 4 years. So Dr. Benjamin Rush, the father of American psychiatry, he started an inpatient psychiatric hospital in Philadelphia. Not a lot of people know, but Dr. Benjamin Rush was actually a signatory on the Declaration of Independence.
Only
Dr.
physician.
Dr. Benjamin Rush, a physician. He's one of three physicians who signed the Declaration of Independence. He also led the Pennsylvania delegation to adopt the U.S. Constitution. So there is an interconnection between psychiatry, American psychiatry, and the Constitution and the law. And Dr. Rush advocated really for his patients to receive treatment. He had some novel treatments, inpatient psychiatric care, that he felt would help people, as well as other medication remedies that he proposed to help patients. So American psychiatry is not very foreign to the concept of the Constitution and the law. I personally have had a lot of legal experience. Part of practicing psychiatry in Pennsylvania in the United States, you get a lot of individuals who come to the inpatient psychiatric units who are involuntarily hospitalized. So not on an unusual basis, three times a week, I would have interactions with courts, mental health courts that are attorneys. I would see attorneys three times a week. I would interact with them. We would do mental health hearings to see if a person should be compelled to stay involuntarily in the hospital. I've also been involved as an expert witness in multiple cases where individuals were thought to be not guilty by reason of insanity. I've testified in state court. I've testified in federal court. I've been on the stand for many, many days, sometimes presenting to juries about people who are on death penalty cases. So I had a significant legal experience. So for me, interactions with the law and the agents and the Department of Justice, especially that it was personal, was very upsetting, but I had some significant legal knowledge that I was able to start navigating that very, very actively when the investigation started.
So talk us through those types of encounters. Were they pleasant in nature? Were they more factual, perfunctory? And when did you notice that they were taking a dive towards an indictment? Were there ever any clues that they were dropping that was the direction they were headed?
Sure. So we learned once the indictment happened, we learned kind of the trajectory of this investigation. We learned that it resulted from patients complaining about, and these are patients in rural areas of Pennsylvania who are underserved and who are poor. And they were complaining that they noticed that they were being told by Medicare that they had to pay a copayment to our practice. They had voiced concerns about this copayment And they have voiced concerns about the fact that some services were not provided. So in January of 2018, the Office of Inspector General for Department of Health and Human Services initiated this investigation. Unbeknownst to me, I was not aware that this investigation had been initiated. And they interviewed several staff members who were frightened and scared and agreed with the agents on everything that was told to them, that we were providing services that were not justified. And subsequently, in June of 2019, the Office of Inspector General asked for a search warrant for our office to obtain medical records. And they were able to come to our office. It was more of a inspection visit rather than a raid. They were pretty respectful. They came and they interviewed people, and we closed the office for that day. But they were quite respectful and obtained records that they had asked to obtain. They came and also made copies of our computer systems and took these information. And then they disappeared, and we didn't hear anything from them until December 2021. What happened in the interim was that we were in communication with them. I had hired an attorney to figure out what was going on, and there was no inkling that there was anything criminal that was going on. But we were trying to provide as much as information as we can to alleviate any concerns. We were not aware of what were they investigating or what was the issue that they were investigating. So they never shared that with us. And so later on in 2021, they gave us some concerns that they were heading toward an indictment, but they never told us. And then the indictment came in November of 2022. So the investigation, the entire investigation, took almost 5 years, and the period that they investigated was about 7 years, and then the trial didn't happen till about 1.5 year later. So the entire investigation spanned from 2015, and the trial didn't happen till May of 2024. So almost 9 years of agony and suffering where we're having to deal with this issue. And fortunately, we were vindicated in court, and the majority of the government theory was found to be not correct.
See, that's the part that I think people really need to emphasize, because as you're detailing this story, it's something that's sadly all too common. A patient complaint, staff testimony, and next thing you know, the physician is investigated and indicted. And in the general public, the sentiment is, well, you must have done something. Something must have been going on. But people don't realize how frivolous the patient complaints and the staff testimonies can truly be in the grand scheme of things. Can you talk a little bit about how the government created the case against you, what they considered as evidence, whether it was just a random complaint or just a staff member who was simply saying whatever the federal government wanted him or her to say? What was the actual evidence that they're trying to compile against you?
Sure. So the evidence was a combination of multiple things. Staff complaints or staff statements. The staff was coerced, and I'll talk a little bit about that when I talk about what happened in trial. The staff was coerced to give the statements that were compatible with the government theory. Basically, the patient's complaints were misconstrued. And then during the search warrant, the government obtained medical records to look at what services we provided for those patients that they have decided that there were issues with. They've also expanded their search into other parts of our practice. They initially wanted to focus only about nursing home patients, They looked at hospital patients. They looked at patients who were in the outpatient practice. They didn't find anything that satisfied whatever they were looking for. And so they only restricted the case to patients who were in the nursing home. Basically, that was basically that's when the kind of the case theory fell apart. It was quite unfortunate because throughout this whole ordeal, the individuals who've decided on this investigation and whether it would proceed were only the prosecutor, an assisted United States attorney with the Department of Justice, with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Pennsylvania, the Eastern Pennsylvania U.S. Attorney's Office, and then two agents from the Office of the Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services. They never relied on any coders. They never relied on any physicians, on the opinion of any physicians. It was just three people who have little knowledge by their admission about the rules and regulations of Medicare, little knowledge about the practice of psychiatry, that gathered together and crafted this indictment that was full of erroneous information. And when we received the pretrial document from the government, when it was set to go to trial, we really saw the calamity in terms of the errors that the government had made in terms of understanding this case, even based simply on the coding rules and the American Medical Association current procedural terminology, the CPT. It was not even compliant with the CPT. They just made up all the findings that they had detailed in the indictment, and we were able to proceed with that.
That's a very good point. Just the lack of clinically substantial or medically factual evidence with air quotes, is often the basis for many government cases against physicians. Why didn't the prosecutors just dismiss? Or why didn't the judge instruct the prosecutors to simply dismiss, knowing how frivolous the evidence against you really was? What kept it going?
I think that the prosecution really thought highly of the statements of the employees, that the services that we were providing were not accurate. They also relied on the misguided evidence from the agents, and they also got a erroneous opinion from the contractor coder for the Center for Medicare Services that gave them the wrong opinion. The entire four charges centered on the description of what services psychiatrists provide. We provide services that are a combination of both medication management or evaluation and management services, and a combination of psychotherapy. The government entire theory was that we didn't provide any psychotherapy. We never talked to our patients. Our visits were only medication evaluation, where we only wrote prescriptions and basically didn't do any talking with our patients. And very unfortunately for the government, they chose four cases for the care of four patients where that was not the case. Those were patients who had severe psychiatric illness. Those were patients who were experiencing severe depression, anxiety, behavioral problems, and suicidal ideation. And the government stood up in court and said that we never talked to these patients. We just changed their medications and went on our way. And they utilized a terminology from the old current procedural terminology. They used the term medication check, 15 minutes medication check, a term that was actually discontinued from the American Medical Association current procedural terminology in 2012. And they were applying that concept to services that were provided between 2015 and 2022. So even on that, they were wrong on the CPT coding. And then they never looked at what services we documented. We showed by reviewing those records of the documentation that were presented in court, that were notes that the government presented, that there was actually psychotherapy provided. And the government could not bring anybody to say that there was no psychotherapy provided. The government was surprised that we fought with them on the issue of that these notes were actually not medication checks. These were actually psychotherapy notes along with management of medications to alleviate the symptoms of these patients. So it was the opposite of what was the government was proposing. And we brought in a certified coder, and we brought in a practicing psychiatrist to provide those testimonies. And we were successful in terms of convincing the jury that that was actually the case, and that the government had no basis to claim that these were services that were not provided.
Let's touch on that a little bit, because I think that's very important. You brought in a professional coder. You brought in another psychiatrist. Talk at a high level, and then maybe talk at a more specific level, how you constructed your defense. It seems very clear that the clinical evidence was your legal argument. But can you talk a little bit more about how you pieced together the clinical justification for your legal argument?
Sure. So a lot of people who are not versed in the legal jargon believe that you can go, especially in federal court, that you can go to court and you can say whatever you want and you can present your evidence and people would listen to you. But the federal trials are governed by a very rigid and intricate system of evidence, the criminal federal rules of evidence. So every piece of evidence that you have to present or you want to present, you have to create relevance, you have to create context, and you have to bring somebody to be able to testify to that piece of evidence that you are presenting. And if you have a very well experienced and versed criminal defense attorney, they would be able to guide you in that process. The other issue that we were able to really hone in on and punch a big hole in the government's case is the fact that we were able to eliminate what we call hearsay evidence. A lot of the evidence that the government wanted to present were agents saying, well, employee so-and-so told me this, employee so-and-so told me this. And my attorney was able to limit that evidence because that is all hearsay evidence. Unless you bring in a witness to the court to testify to those facts, it's all hearsay evidence. And I see that happens a lot in a lot of trials where the government just tries to bring in additional issues and additional hearsay issues that are not relevant and sometimes will distract the jury and sometimes will poison the jury's mind when the government is able to bring in some of the hearsay evidence. Also, we were able to successfully focus the jury's attention just on these four charges. I know when you did your presentation and introduction, one of the additional charges that the government, or it wasn't a charge, it was just highly innuendo. Scandalous material and headline grabbing. And they said, well, Dr. Rafai sent bills on deceased patients. Dr. Rafai billed on the same patients in two different places. Well, when those issues were presented in court, one of them was that the government didn't collect their data correctly. We showed that their allegation was that I billed on deceased patients. And we found, and they give us a list. They give us 25 patients. And then we looked at that list. There were 5 patients who died before I was born. So there was no way that I would have even known these patients. So Medicare services had an artificial intelligence bot that goes into the system and grabs services that were provided after the patient was deceased. But that bot is not imperfect. It brought in about 50-60% of junk claims that were not even related to me. Individuals who actually died before I was born. Individuals where they claim I provided services or I sent in claims for services when I was in kindergarten, when I was in elementary school, when I was in high school, when I was in medical school. So parsing through the data, what happens is these agents just collected this data and submitted this indictment with no review. Many, many times throughout this ordeal, the U.S. Attorney's Office and the agents would pressure, my attorney would pressure me that their evidence was overwhelming, that they had so much evidence. Why am I not submitting a plea? I should plea. I should give in. The evidence is overwhelming. You're going to lose in trial, and then we're going to go for more jail time. You got to prepare yourself. And I believed in my innocence. I believed that they had no case, and a lot of the data that they were presenting was erroneous. And this is why I decided to go to trial, even at the risk of having a more severe sentence at the end versus just giving up and submitting a plea.
Yeah, I admire your courage, and it's something that, to be quite frank, I wish I had at the time as well. And I just have all the respect in the world for you. I want to touch on the misinformation and disinformation that the government is presenting. Now, you and I, having that experience, can kind of get a sense of how much willful dishonesty there is on the government's end. But I want to keep this very factual. So I want to avoid the speculation angle on the government's impact and their means to influence the outcomes in a case by using salacious information. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the media storm that you encountered throughout this process, from investigation to indictment, when you would see these news headlines like twice billing one deceased patient, twice billing different locations. What kind of impact did that have on you when you started to see all these media clips? And did you ever wonder why the media is so, I want to use the word complicit, but I want to be respectful and say why the media is so willing to allow these headlines to go through. What are your thoughts on all that?
Oh, sure. So, I mean, the newspaper in my area, when the indictment came, published the indictment, but published news about the indictment. They were fair. They allowed my attorney to put in a statement that we did not believe the charges and we believed that we were going to be vindicated. That was the star of the article. Lehigh Valley psychiatrist indicted for Medicare fraud and for billing on deceased patients. But they actually allowed me the opportunity to provide a statement in that. My attorney, Mr. Paul Hatznecker, law professor Paul Hatznecker, provided a statement indicating that he believed in my innocence and that I was going to be vindicated. And they actually published a follow-up article after the jury gave the verdict of not guilty. Newspaper, Lehigh Valley Live newspaper, actually did publish a detailed article about the trial. I also pushed them to contact the United States Attorney's Office of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania for comments on the verdict. And actually, the U.S. Attorney's Office did not give any comments about the verdict. They were quick to send out a press release, but they did not provide any comments on the verdict. Just because of the tremendous issue with the fact that this was a big loss for a United States attorney that was advocating herself as being somebody who wanted to go after Medicare fraud. She was herself a Medicare fraud investigator prior to becoming a U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. So that was a major issue in that. It was a big issue in the U.S. Attorney's office. Hopefully that would be a learning experience of how sometimes they're wrong, and somehow the investigative agents are wrong. But they have what we call a confirmation bias. They've already decided that there's something going on, and they move with the case. I think one of the main things that went on in the trial is that we saw things changing in the trial very, very quickly. The investigative agent, who was actually the first witness in the trial, basically testified about what happened in the investigation. And I'm going to mention her name because she's a public figure. She was actually an analyst with the Office of Inspector General for Department of Health and Human Services. And then she became an agent. She became a special agent to investigate. But before that, she did analysis of Medicare services. Her name is Special Agent Stephanie Yeager. And she was the first witness who basically presented evidence. And a federal criminal trial is, as my attorney tells me, Mr. Paul Hetznecker, about 40% is actually theatrics for the jury, the lawyers, and about 40% is evidence, and there's 20% luck. So kind of the luck of your jury selection and whether your jury is receptive to you or not. But 40% is theatrics, what happens in the trial and how you behave and how you sit, and you're not supposed to shake your head or just make any motions that would give the jury negative vibes about you. So you sit still and you basically take it. But on the stand, this agent would tell my attorney on cross-examination, she would point at me and said, "Here's Dr. Rafai. He stole from Medicare. He took money from poor people, Medicare recipients and Medicare beneficiaries. He would charge them money that they did not owe, and he stole money from Medicare." She kept saying that. This is the agent. And so actually, we were able to turn around that testimony. She had talked about this fact, the patient who gave the complaint, and what was the reason for the complaint, that we were charging people who did not owe co-payments, we were charging them co-payments. And that was the whole start of the investigation. We were able to find Medicare documents from Medicare. They had started the investigation in January of 2018. And we found a Medicare document that from Medicare database that was publicly available that Medicare published in March of 2018 that we confronted the agent with. And in that document, basically, Medicare talks about this topic, about collecting co-payments from poor patients. They're called a qualified Medicare beneficiary. They have Medicare and Medicaid. And he reviewed that. It was a two-page document, and he reviewed the first paragraph with her. And even then, she went again and said, "See? This is what I told you. I told you this Dr. Rafai is stealing from Medicare." And so we reviewed with her the remainder of the document. And the last paragraph was basically an admission from Medicare. And it starts with, "Due to unforeseen circumstances in 2017, the Medicare billing system caused errors to result in bills being sent to patients and providers being notified that their patients owed money while they did not owe any money." And this was basically the whole court was silent. It was in Medicare's own admission in their own documents that 3 months after they started this investigation, Medicare owned up to it and said that in 2017, we had this computer issue, we had this computer glitch, but now we fixed it. But 2017, it was all a computer glitch. And she basically admitted on the stand that she did not know about this issue and that they had started this whole investigation based on a computer glitch from Medicare that was in writing. And I think that kind of transformed the entire trial from there on. The jury just saw things completely different. The judge actually started seeing things completely different. And witness after witness, we were able to bring in evidence that we actually did everything the right way. That yes, we did mistakes. There were some billing errors where we sent in the incorrect information. We retracted it. We would send statements to Medicare that it was a billing error, and we corrected it. We showed that in times when we made errors, we returned money to Medicare. And since that, the first witness basically just turned, and that was the investigative agent when we actually got her on why this investigation started. She was surprised, and it just kind of changed completely. And then when it was our time to present our case, I actually presented a coder that actually gave the jury about a 15-20 minute lesson on what is psychotherapy and how is psychotherapy coded and how is psychotherapy provided and what needs to be in the record. And the jury understood that very easily. And when we showed the four notes, when the government showed the four notes that they were saying these were charges where we billed for psychotherapy that was not provided, the jury was very easily able to understand that that wasn't the case, that these were psychotherapy services that were provided. And then we brought in a practicing psychiatrist who said, psychotherapy is basically the bread and butter of psychiatry. These were patients, destitute patients in nursing homes who were depressed, who were having psychiatric emergencies, and Dr. Rafai and his staff ran and provided these services to these patients. So the jury saw a completely different picture than the indictment, than the press release, than the newspaper article of what we provided to our patients.
Wow. Well said. That's amazing. With that being said, what takeaways or lessons would you have for other physicians who might find themselves in similar unfortunate circumstances?
This is an unfortunate situation. It took a big emotional toll on myself, a big emotional toll on my family. I mean, I'm the president of the local psychiatric society. To have this negative news about me, this okay, he's charged with Medicare fraud, he's going to close his offices, people are not going to come and see him. And just to give you a picture, and I'm smiling about it after the fact, of how much there is dysfunction in our government. So I am being prosecuted by the United States Department of Justice, the United States Attorney's Office for the Eastern Pennsylvania District, as well as the Office of the Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services. The Center for Medicare Services is not involved in that entire process. I have a lot of Medicare patients. We had about 250 Medicare patients. And the Center for Medicare Services says, well, Dr. Rafai, you work in a rural area. There is no other psychiatrist to see these patients. We understand that there is an investigation, but we want you to continue to see these patients because there's nobody else to see them. We want you to continue to see them, provide them care. We're not going to pay you, but we're going to hold this money in an escrow account for you to be available once you resolve these legal issues. If these legal issues are not resolved, we're going to take the money but you are providing free services to these Medicare patients. So just kind of to show the kind of the dysfunction and how separated these organizations are. And luckily we're hopefully trying to mend that relationship with the Center for Medicare Services. But basically the right arm doesn't tell what the left arm is doing. And this was part of Medicare system glitched and caused a patient to complain to the Office of the Inspector General that didn't know that the Medicare system glitched. And same thing here. Medicare didn't care. They wanted the patients to be seen. They didn't care if the Office of Inspector General was investigating. The Department of Justice had a criminal case. Just see the patients and that's it. So just to show you how people just wouldn't believe that this is true unless it's happening to them. And I'm giving you this experience of what has happened to me.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I think stories like yours are incredibly important because it highlights the complexity of law and medicine and how many physicians find themselves at the crosshairs of prosecutors who may not truly understand the clinical basis for which they're investigating. And I think it's important that the public realize that these cases, although they're sensationalized in the media, are far more nuanced than the media clips would have you believe. And I think your case is a prime example of that. And the courage that you've exhibited is incredible. And I want to now get a sense of what's next for you. Do you resume practice? Can you resume practice? I know that you're practicing in some capacity, but just emotionally, does it feel the same?
It doesn't feel the same. It does not feel the same. Just to give you an example of also, these services are part of my commitment to the community. The services that I got prosecuted on and that the government claimed were fraudulent were part of my commitment. We lost money on these services. We paid more salary to people than we received money from Medicare. And it was to indigent Medicare beneficiaries. But that didn't matter. That didn't matter to the government. There were trains that were supposed to go from station A to station B. Station B is the trial and a conviction. And if they can circumvent, if they can get people to plea on the way, that's fine. There was no care. During COVID, I'm in a rural area. I was contacted by the Pennsylvania Department of Health. And they said, Dr. Rafai, there's no practices in your area that are giving COVID vaccines. Would you volunteer to give COVID vaccines? I said, absolutely. I will respond. Whenever my country calls for my service, I leave everything and respond. I'll give my life for this country.
While the investigation was going on.
While the investigation was going on, the Pennsylvania Department of Health doesn't care. They said, can you do COVID vaccination? Absolutely. So we gave around 3,000 COVID shots in my community. I vaccinated probably about 2% of the population of Northampton County, Pennsylvania. That's where I live.
Wow. While the investigation. Dr. Rafai, I have to stop you at this moment to just applaud you for your patriotic services. Very few physicians go out of their way to support the medical community, the public, in ways that you have shown. And to do so while all of this is going on is absolutely incredible. The key takeaway that I get from this, and I would love your thoughts on this, the key takeaway that I'm getting is that the government, while we describe it as one word, is really a multitude of agencies and indeed personalities. And though one or two personalities may be engaging in activity that's medically harmful by using the law in inappropriate ways, it doesn't encapsulate all of government. It doesn't encapsulate all of the agencies and how they interact. What are your thoughts on that notion of how physicians should interact and recognize this concept of government?
Sure. So a physician really needs to be cognizant of his rights. So whenever there is a word of an investigation or they hear that there are law enforcement asking about them, they should immediately retain an attorney. That was one of the main things that really, really helped me is retaining expert attorneys who specialize in healthcare. Don't get your neighborhood attorney who does wills and divorces and things like that. You need an attorney that specializes in healthcare. And for example, my attorney, Mr. Paul Hetznecker, he's a criminal defense attorney, but he is very well versed in healthcare. His dad is a psychiatrist and his brother is a psychiatrist. So he was very familiar with the field of psychiatry. And that was very, very helpful in terms of how he was able to present my case to the jury to a successful end. I also had another group that was assisting me, the Chapman Law Group and the Chapman Investigative Group. They specialize in healthcare investigations. And they were able to bring in a group of investigators that specialize in healthcare that were able to interview witnesses and present evidence at trial about the services that we provided and about how patients were happy with our services. So these cases require very focused experts that basically focus on the charges and requires a lot of compassionate witnesses that will convey to the jury and will be able to suppress some of the stigma that the government kind of creates during this trial. One of the witnesses that the Chapman Law Group helped me with was a patient that I had seen for 7 years. She was a Medicare beneficiary. Basically, she came to me at age 20 and she had developed schizophrenia. And she hadn't left her home in 2 years. Her dad was a physician. Her mom is a nurse. And I turned her life around with the help of her family. And we started her on medications. And she actually went to nursing school. And she became a registered nurse. And she worked on the inpatient psychiatric unit while all being my patient. So the Chapman Investigative Group were able to contact her, convince her to come to the courtroom and talk to the jury about her experience with the services that I provided. And her voice still rings in my ear. She talks about how we treated her, how she became a registered nurse now and a productive member of society. And she looked at the jury and she said, "Release Dr. Rafai. Release Dr. Rafai. He saved my life." This is my message to her message to the jury. And I think that resonated with the jury a lot because they saw compassionate patients that testified on behalf of the physician. So these cases require a lot of witnesses and you need a good investigative arm, a good attorney to be able to kind of push back on these cases because the government will basically have unlimited resources. And talking about unlimited resources, we talked about how much did it cost the government to conduct all of this investigation. It probably cost them more than they would have collected from me. They wanted $1.3 million. The entire investigation probably cost them more than that. Just the jury trial probably cost the government $1 million.
Wow.
Bringing all these juries, a lot of these jurors were not from the area, so they have to put them in hotels. They have to give them transportation. They have to give them food. They had to bring in, to fly in witnesses. They had to fly in people. The trial was about 7-8 days. All of these expenses and all of it to what end? I'm not sure to what end was what did that achieve? I am not sure. It certainly did not achieve justice.
No, it did not. And often that's the emptiness of it all. Was there truly any justice served? And in more cases than not, there is none. Dr. Rafai, yeah. I want to thank you so much for your time. For those who are listening who may want to get a hold of you, just to learn from your experiences, what's a good contact number that they can reach you at?
They could email me on my website, alirifai.com, A-L-Y-R-I-F-A-I, and there's a contact email on that. They could send me a message or they could call my office at 610-253-2500.
And with that, Dr. Rafai, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Okay, Dr. Rafai, if you don't mind just staying on